Welcome to Inspiration Loves Company, a podcast about doing better and being better at life, work, and everything in between. I'm your host, Debbie Epstein Henry, a lawyer turned entrepreneur, public speaker, and author. I'm so glad you're here. Our guest today is David Hornick. David is a venture capitalist, lawyer, educator, and philanthropist. He's a founding partner at Lobby Capital, a Silicon Valley-based venture capital firm. And prior to that, he was a general partner at August Capital. David received Deloitte's 2013 Venture Capitalist of the Year Award and has been honored by Forbes magazine as a member of its Midas list of top venture capitalists. He teaches entrepreneurship at Harvard Law School and business management at Stanford Graduate School of Business. David and his wife, Pamela, are contemporary art collectors. They have four kids. Welcome, David. So great to be with you. It's been ages. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. For our audience, I always love to share how I know my guests if I do. So my recollection is we met in 1994. We're both clerking for federal judges in New York. And I have some really fond memories of those early days. I'm just curious, do you have any memories from those days of us working in the same courthouse?
I mean, they were crazy. It is astonishing that you let young people have so much, you know, at least authority by proxy.
Right.
And I do remember thinking to myself, I definitely should not be making law. That. but it was an astonishing time when you're a young lawyer and you have this ability to sit and hear what cases are, you know, are really influencing the state of our nation. It's a little heady, but I don't think you appreciate that when you're so young.
Right. And so my recollections were more pedestrian from back there. So I remember we both had our first children right around the same time. And if I've got this right, is your oldest Julian?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So I remember taking our oldest Oliver to your son Julian's first birthday party.
Awesome.
And were you possibly in Port Washington, New York?
We were exactly in Port Washington. I found old videos and I recently digitized them. And I have video of that party with us hanging out with all these little people, which is an amazing thing to think back now that our babies are in their late 20s. You know, in fact, you're probably about my age, which means that our babies are now the age we were when we had them.
Exactly. Crazy. I remember at that birthday party, as a little party favor, you guys gave these Rafi music tape cassettes as gifts with handwritten writing. And that was when we first started listening to Rafi with our kids. And then the other thing I remember was one day seeing you at work and all of a sudden sort of smelled something. And then I saw something on your collar and I think it was spit up.
Oh, nice.
Do you remember that?
That seems very reasonable. I have to say that I've had a lifetime of no boundaries since. I ultimately had four kids. And at one point I was a practicing attorney. It was at night. I was on some conference call and I was changing a diaper while I was negotiating a merger agreement, I think. And the lawyer I was talking with, said, do you want to call me back when you're done with that? And I said, no, I'm good. It's no problem. And he said, well, it's a problem for me. Wow.
That was your signal. You needed to leave the practice of law, of course you did.
Yeah,
that's so right. Great. So I want to talk today with you about risk taking and smart risk taking, which is, in my mind, when looking at how your career has evolved, it just seems to be the essence of what you have done so well, although you've done so many things well. So I'd love to start with, if you can remember, the most significant risk you remember taking in your life, the earliest memory you have. And what do you think gave you the courage to do it?
I mean, I suppose there have been a lot of them because my view has always been, if it seems like it's fun, I should do it.
Right.
And I don't mean that like, oh, I'm going to drive a motorcycle around or jump out of a plane. I don't actually believe in any of those risks. So I don't like, you know, life threatening risks. But
right.
I mean, the most significant in many ways is when I left the law to become a venture capitalist, because by the time I left the law, it was pretty clear that I could do that job. Mm-hmm. Right. That people, I would be you'd ask me to do something. I'd do a good job for you. You'd thank me. You'd pay me. You know, I could go home and eat. So that was good. And then after some fateful board meeting, a very, very successful venture capitalist named Dave Marquardt said to me, have you ever thought about the venture business? And I, of course, I had thought about the venture business. I was like, yes, I'd love to do that. And after a bunch of months of interviewing and talking, eventually he said, David, lawyers suck at this, but we like you. And so if you'd like to join us, then welcome. And I thought, sounds great. You know, and it didn't strike me that, hey, this is a really risky shift, right? That I'm going to leave a profession that I have studied for, passed multiple bars for, done all this legwork for a profession that I have no training in. Right. And in fact, was totally unqualified for. I mean, the venture capital business is about finance. It's about business. I had a computer music degree and a law degree and a degree in criminology, right? I mean, I was, couldn't have been less qualified, but it just seemed to me like, what an incredible opportunity that someone's saying, I can come join their firm, look for smart entrepreneurs, help them build big business, seemed great. So I have a very, very clear memory some 5 years into being a venture capitalist that I came home, four kids in bed, sit down with my wife where she's reading. And I say to her, hey, Pamela, I had a realization today. And she said, oh, you know, she did not, there was nothing good that was going to come out of that sentence as far as she was concerned. Said, yeah. I said, well, it struck me that I'm 5 years into being a VC and it's not clear that I'm a good VC. I said, but it is clear that I'm no longer qualified to practice law. And she said, shouldn't you have thought of that? And I said, yeah, I should have thought about it. And she said, it's not my problem. And that was that. It was like, you know, and that was very much Pamela's view all along, was you make good choices and then you deal with the consequences of those choices. And that's where I was. It was, well, go be a successful VC. And so I did, you know, but that was certainly a moment where you're like, oh, wait a second. This had bigger implications than I thought.
Right. I think that actually speaks to risk-taking in the sense that sometimes there's this exhilaration with this new opportunity, which we described at the outset, like, oh, this is fun. This is cool. And this is sexy. And it's nice to be wanted. Probably the allure of it, even without the qualifications, it was that much more flattering. But I do think it's interesting that it's really 5 years in that you had this inflection point. And I wonder, was there any triggering event that made you reflect on it and say, wait, am I actually good at this 5 years in?
Oh, I'm sure it's because some company had failed.
Right.
Because in the venture business, right? I mean, the beauty of the law is that you can do it, right? You know, like there isn't a bunch of mystery to it. You do hard work, you get to answers, you can do it well or poorly. But in the end, there was never a question in my mind that I could be a lawyer, that I would do a good job representing my clients, despite the fact that I'm dyslexic, which being a dyslexic lawyer is, of course, moronic. So in some ways, that was the biggest risk, is like, hey, yeah, let's go join a profession where reading is the key. The venture business is very different, right? You invest in a set of companies, they could all fail. And now 23 years into being a venture capitalist, nearly half of the companies I've invested in over that time have failed, have gone to basically zero. That isn't determinative. It turns out that's kind of the norm. But if you think about it, if you were a lawyer and 50% of the time you did a bad job, you know, that would go poorly for you. Whereas venture, it's like, keep up the good work, you know, just need to have one great client.
So do you feel like that's part of what evolves for you being in VC, is that you have this different risk tolerance because the statistics are different? It's like being a baseball player. It's like you have to adjust to that. Is that part of the learning?
That's either something you're comfortable with or catastrophic. You know, I think it's very tough for lots of people. I talk to young venture capitalists and the pressure of that is astonishing. And oftentimes young venture capitalists make a mistake And they think that when the companies they've invested in go out of business and they lose $2 or $10 or $20 million, whatever it is, that, oh my God, that's the worst mistake I've made. And it turns out it's not at all. If they're lucky, it's not at all the worst mistake. The worst mistake was someone pitched them on the next most amazing business and they said, nah, I'm not going to fund that. That's the worst mistake you make in venture capital. So over time, you realize you're constantly making mistakes and you just need to stay engaged and help the businesses you fund, and some number of them will succeed. And if they do so, then you can declare success and continue doing the job. The challenge is that the job is then to go make a bunch more bets, which you may be totally wrong about.
Right. And what qualifies somebody to make better bets? What other qualities do you think makes people good at this kind of field?
Wow. I have a brand new partner who's fantastic, incredibly smart, thoughtful gentleman who at our partner meeting said, so you all have been at this a long time. What have you learned, basically? And we all went, because it turns out, I always compare it to optometry, right? Imagine, because the business is a little bit of like, oh, which one's better, this or this? You make a bet, but then imagine you only went into your optometrist every 7 years. Like 7 years later, you find out, oh, that was not better or that was worse. Great. Now this one, if you did that, your eyes would change before you got any of the feedback. And that's a little what happens in the venture business is you make a set of choices, you fund a bunch of smart people, the markets shift, everything changes, right? When I started in the venture business, we funded this amazing company because the founders said that they thought the technology was such that they could move data through the air. And we're like, really? What makes you think you can move data through the air? And this incredible professor described why it was a time. And then she went on to invent Wi-Fi. Like, think about that.
Wow.
This is, we funded this founder when it was two founders and a good idea that turned into Wi-Fi. That's amazing. That makes me sound so old. But then, since then, I funded a company called Splunk, which is like this search engine for machine data. And at the time, no one was really paying attention to data. And now everything is data. And then all of a sudden AI emerges, and not only is it data, but it's the ability for your computer to tell you what to do with that data, et cetera. So every day you wake up and you're like, well, that's different. I better rethink that 100%.
I guess part of what makes you not just smart in it is how much you read and what you read. Is that a lot of what gives you the confidence to make some of those decisions?
Well, interestingly, of course, as I said, I'm dyslexic. Yeah. So if it's what I read, I'm doomed. but one of the things that's great about the venture business is that so much of it is what you hear as opposed to what you read. I'm talking to people every day.
Right.
My typical year, I get hundreds and hundreds of great ideas in my inbox. And then those people come and tell me what they're working on and they tell me why they think it's interesting. Right. And so suddenly you get to understand, oh, how does AI work? Well, here's how it's being used in these contexts, et cetera. If you're lucky, you're surrounded by some of the smartest people on the planet, and they tell you. And so every day I'm getting this education about technology and markets and all these things that that I otherwise did not bring to the job. Mm. And that's amazing. And as long as you stay extraordinarily curious and extraordinarily engaged, then you'll end up learning lots and lots of stuff. You still may make bad choices, right? I've turned down some of the best businesses in the history of time. but I have also funded amazing people and I've seen astonishing things, and that's what makes it so fun.
So picking up on that, what are some of the big opportunities you've declined and what have you learned from those misses?
See, this goes back to like, oh, David, surely you've learned something. You can't have done these things and then be like, well, that was a shame, but But a little
I'm
bit
pressing on you on this. Our audience needs these answers. You got to come
answers.
Up with
answers. David, your platitudes are useless. We need some answers here. You know, I run this crazy conference. It's called the Lobby Conference, where a bunch of smart people get together and they talk about the stuff that's interesting to them. The founders of Uber met each other at my conference. They went and created Uber. Then they actually raised their seed round at the conference, and anybody who gave them money in that seed round did extraordinarily well. And then, of course, the founders then came to me to talk with me about the Series A financing, their first big financing. And I had backed both of their previous companies. So it was like, oh, well, there it is. And at the time, all there was Uber Black, right? Just the kind of limousine service. And we talked about it as a partnership and said, this is an amazing experience, but how many people need this? How many people are sitting around going, I just need a limousine to come pick me up from dinner? We thought it was a little bit like a rich person toy at the time. And so we ended up passing on the round, and obviously, you know, the history, then they copied UberX, which ended up being a giant business. And then out of it emerged things like Uber Eats, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So when you look at that, the mistake I made wasn't that I misunderstood the scale of the opportunity, right? The opportunity at the time was actually relatively contained. It was that when you're looking at these businesses, you really should be looking into what is fundamentally different about what they're doing, what is fundamentally valuable of what they were doing. And the, my oldest son, Julian, is here right now. And we just drove by the AT&T store, where he stood outside in line to get the very first iPhone for me. Right. He likes to point that out. You made me stand in line for hours for your iPhone. But we got that first iPhone, this first amazing thing. And what was new about it? It was really just a little computer that sat in your pocket. It was a bad phone. It was, you know, but at the time, I remember thinking the only thing that's different about this is that it is location aware, that it knows where you are, and therefore mm-hmm. it can do all sorts of cool things. You can pull up a map and see where you are. That's amazing. And so I was looking for, well, what is going to take advantage of that? What business is going to take advantage of the idea that this thing is location aware? And then I turned down Uber, the perfect example of what would take advantage of that. And that's what kills me in retrospect, right? Mm. Another great example, my friend Reid Hoffman had seed funded Facebook, and he said, oh, David, you really need to meet with Mark. He's raising this Series A, and for a variety of reasons, didn't end up engaging there. And that was the best venture investment that was ever made. So that was a mistake. Now that I look back on it, I can tell you there was a moment in time where, you know, the universe was literally yelling at me, David, you moron, there will be a time in the future when you could make the most important decision of your life. Do not screw it up. I had traveled with my wife. I was speaking at a conference in Europe. I was in a little hotel. And this was at a time when you had a dedicated computer in the lobby or whatever to go check email. And I was down in the lobby. I wanted to check my email. There was some young American kid on the computer. And for like 35, 40 minutes, I just waited. And finally, she looked back at me. She said, oh, I'm sorry. I'm happy to give you the computer. I'm just playing around on Facebook. Oh, my God. 40 minutes. She probably was there an hour earlier. And I didn't say to myself, wow, this girl is in Italy. And she is sitting in the lobby of this conference on Facebook for an hour while I wait. And that didn't strike me. Didn't strike me that was relevant information. Oh, it just kills me to this day. But so, you know, you have to be astonishingly cognizant of what's happening in the world and the market and the people, and sometimes you get it right and sometimes you get it wrong. And you know, I turned down the Series A of Twitter. I turned down the Series A of Palantir. I turned down the Series A. I mean, just, but what are you going to do?
Well, you've also had tremendous success. And what strikes me is you have to be doing all the things you've indicated, but also be thinking of the derivative opportunities. So with Uber, this seems like a rich person's toy, as you said, and who needs these limousines? But then to see that, oh, wait, it could be these other ways that this model can be then amplified or redirected. Seeing those steps in advance is really something.
I mean, you know, we did about the same time we funded a company that is now called Turo, T-U-R-O. And it was a car sharing company where the founder said, wouldn't it be great if instead of renting a car from a rental car company, you just rented it from someone in your neighborhood. So you need a truck and you say, oh, someone in my neighborhood has a truck. I'll rent that truck for an hour. I need to go to the mountains to ski. Where's a four-wheel drive vehicle? And so at the time they had 10 cars sitting in and around Cambridge, Mass. And one of my partners said, this is a terrible business. I've done the math. This is a terrible business. It doesn't work. And I remember having the conversation with that partner and saying, well, it doesn't work with 10 cars. It may not even work with 10,000 cars, but at 100,000 cars, it's pretty amazing. And, oh, David, like, enough. Anyway, my partner, Howard, thankfully funded this company. And today it is more than 100,000 cars on the platform. And you can rent a BMW, you can rent a Tesla, you can rent a tank. I mean, just amazing. And it turns out that at that kind of scale, wherever you go, you can find the vehicle you're looking for. It's brought to you. It's cheaper. It's a better experience. But many, many people looked at that when there were 10 cars and said, that's just a terrible idea. You know, right. It never gets to be big enough to be of interest. So sometimes you get it right and sometimes you don't.
Most of our audience, they're not in VC. And what I'd love to think about is there's so much fear of failure. That's why people don't take risks. And I wonder, how can we think about using failure productively? Do you have any thoughts about that? From your experience?
Well, I think to a certain degree, my view of failure was always, and this goes back to my earlier point, if I'm not a risk taker in the jump out of an airplane, right, you know, wear a wingsuit kind of person, my view is failure is great. Like, I just don't know why failure is a problem as long as you have the capacity to recover, right? So right, these things from which one can't recover, of course, that's a terrible idea. Right. And so, or one could commit a huge amount of one's life to a set of things that don't come to fruition. And if you haven't gained a huge amount of, you know, happiness from the path, then of course that's really a problem.
Right.
But to me, in every instance, there were two overarching things about the choices I made that even though they were risky and they could have led to failure and often did lead to failure, they made it fine, which is, one, I absolutely enjoyed the journey. I still enjoy the journey. And secondly, I only went on that journey with people who were amazing, right? Mm-hmm. If you make choices, if you take risks with people, right? I'm just going to take this risk on my own and I'm, you know, live and die by my own failures. And let's all grab hands and take a risk together and see what we build. And if it goes well, that's amazing because there's nothing better than a collective experience with people you love where you succeed.
Right.
And if you fail, it's not so bad because you have a group of people you love and care about. And you're like, wow, that was hard and it didn't work out, but it was great to do it. You know,
something that I find really interesting about your background is you've come to a lot of these choices looking at the world differently. And one example of that is when you were featured in Adam Grant's best-selling book, Give and Take, and he starts the book with you. Could you tell us about that story of why he featured you and the message behind it?
Yeah, I mean, all of these, if you look in the end, all these things are sort of strung together moments in time where I don't know if it's risks, but it is. Look, I just have always said, if I have a thing to say, I'm going to say it. If I have a, you know, if I think there's someone great, I'll support them. And so I flew over to England to speak at an event. And it was just because a friend of mine said, hey, we have this thing called Silicon Valley Comes to the UK, and it's really great. You get to go visit entrepreneurs over in the UK, and you went to Cambridge, and we'll visit the students in Cambridge. I was like, oh, this is great. Totally. I'd love to do that. I've done it every year since, for like 20. And I've become incredibly good friends with the people who run it, and they've done amazing stuff. And while I was there, I was speaking on a panel and saying crazy things, because that's what I do. Crazy, just like whatever strikes me in an animated way. And right. Particularly in England,
the decorum is a little different.
Yeah, like, wow, this little
he
man
really is American.
Really, really curious. And the editor of Wired magazine in the UK heard the speech and came up to me afterwards. And it was because I had a blog at the time. And this was in the very early days of blogging. So talk about risky. I started the very first venture capital blog. Before that, no one talked about venture capital. They thought that it was this black box. And if we told you about it, you would know all the secrets. And I remember saying to my partners, who again had been some of the most successful venture investors ever, my partner Dave was the only private investor in Microsoft. He sat on that board for 33 years, like crazy. And I said, I'm going to write about this. And he's like, no, we don't talk about it. And I said, but why? Like, wouldn't it be great if entrepreneurs knew more about how we thought about the process, et cetera? And no one could come up with a good reason why not to. And so for months, I wrote without publishing it, just so my partners could read it and list and say, okay, great. That's fine. So I start this blog, and suddenly people are learning about the venture business. It's like, wow, this is how you think, and these are the things you care about. And so because I had this blog, the Wired editor said, oh, I read your blog, and it's really great because you say whatever you think. It's, you know, and he said, if you ever have something you want to write about, let me know. I said, oh, awesome. I'd be thrilled to do that. Just ping me when there's an opportunity. And as I was driving to the airport, I get a call from that editor. And he said, oh, someone just dropped out who was supposed to write a commentary for my next issue of Wired. Do you have anything you want to talk about? And I had just read this article that pissed me off. And it was about researchers at Harvard and Stanford Business School who had determined that being mean was a good business strategy and got you better outcomes. And I was just like, that's just not true.
Right.
So I said, I absolutely have something to write about. When do you need it by? And he said, well, if you could get it to me immediately, that'd be great. And I said, well, I'm flying to San Francisco, so I'll be on a plane for 12 or 13 hours, whatever it is. So I'll send you the thing when I land. He said, oh, amazing. So I write this thing for Wired, and it's entitled Nice Guys Finish First Eventually. And I just said, this is stupid. The idea that you could be a bad person and a mean person and somehow be long-term successful in business is completely moronic. It's devoid of the fact that business is about repeat experiences. And if you are mean to someone, they remember. We remember who is a jerk, and we remember who is great and who we want to work with. So I write this, then all sorts of people tell me what an idiot I am. What do you know? And you question this research just because you say so, et cetera. Anyway, fast forward, Adam is writing this book on givers and takers and the idea that people who are givers are ultimately more successful than the takers, which was exactly my point.
Right.
And some researcher of his finds my article and says, hey, do you mind catching up? Sure, great. I'm happy to. And he and I got on the phone, and he's an amazing guy. And we talked for, I don't know, 2 hours more, you know, and it was such a fun conversation. He was like, David, thank you. This has been amazing. And I just told him the truth about everything, including the story that is the beginning of the Give and Take book, which is an instance where I was a good guy and I did all the things right. And then this entrepreneur said, nah, I'm not going to take your money. I'm going to take money of this other person. Because as much as my heart wants to go with you, my head says I should take the money of this other person. And I was devastated and thought this was catastrophic and let this investor know, I'm sorry, this founder know, you've made a mistake. This is an unacceptable outcome. And, you know, I can't, otherwise I have to change my whole worldview. And you don't want me to change my worldview, do you? Like, he cares, you know? Right. And don't you think the world should be a world in which those who are helpful to you and those of us who are engaged in giving should be rewarded? And ultimately that founder, a guy named Danny Shader, said, yes, I do agree with that. And he changed the financing to include me in the financing. And Adam loved that story. I'll tell you, the reason he really loved it was the story arc, which is David is a giver and therefore he's a moron and he loses. Oh, wait a second. No, it turns out that's not true after all, right? That was, right. You know, so that became the first chapter of Give and Take, and it's an amazing thing to be featured in a New York Times bestseller as someone who has made a good decision. But I'll tell you, it also means that I get lots of emails saying, hey, David, you're a giver, give me things. It's like, oh no.
Yeah. I remember reading that and I was like, wait, I know him. And I can't remember if I followed up with you at that time. I may have written you a note on LinkedIn at the time, but it certainly stuck with me. And it's such a powerful thing. I wanted to ask you, you've mentioned a couple times about being dyslexic, and I know you've done a TED talk on that. Is there anything from that experience you think that has helped inform your risk taking?
Well, I think it has to, right? I sort of joke that I never have all the information in a sentence. So everything is a risk. Like everything, you know, I read a book and it's like, I wonder if it said what I thought it said. So so a lot of it is just risk taking. It's saying I'm willing to bet that the things I have intuited from the information I can glean is sufficient that I can make a reasonable determination. Smart people, right? Read. Smart people gather a huge amount of data by reading all this information and then they incorporate it and make good decisions. And that's not how I can make decisions. That's not what I do. And so I do think that's risky in a lot of cases, right? You make a set of choices on limited information. On the other hand, I think in the venture business, it's not a bad thing because it turns out you never really have all the information. I didn't have all the information on Uber. I made a mistaken choice there because I lacked information about the evolution of this car sharing industry of, you know, et cetera. But I just as easily could have said, oh, that would be amazing if these things happen. Wouldn't it be interesting? And so, great, let's invest in that thing. And I've had the fortune of investing in, you know, four different companies where I funded them when there were a handful of people, and there are now thousands of people in these businesses. These are very big businesses, but at the time I funded them, it was like, wow, that'd be cool if it worked, you know?
Right, and right.
I remember saying to the founders of one of these companies, this would be amazing if you can build it. Can you build it? And they said, yeah. Okay, great. Let's go do that. You know, that's a very risky bet.
Yes. The other thing I think is really challenging as both a parent and a boss is giving other people the room to take some risks and allow them to fail and not to go in and rescue them when they do fail. And give them space to recover. And I wonder if you have any advice on that.
Well, I have a family full of artists and musicians. I have these kids whose ambitions are amazing, but they're also incredibly unlikely, right? My oldest is a composer. My next kid, you know, is a designer who started a record label. My youngest is a fashion designer. And so you look at these things and say, well, that's a terrible idea. But on the other hand,
you want me to cut that part, by the way?
No, absolutely not. They know. I've had these conversations with them because it's like, look, it's a tricky business. All these things are really hard. And yet I'm in the very lucky situation where I can say to them, I love that you want to do that. And I want to support you in doing those things, right? I want you to take those risks. And to some extent, because I have had the fortune of being successful in my business, it's less risky for them. But, you know, in the end, if my son Julian is ultimately not successful at being a composer, he's spent a decade of his life writing music, etc. My son Noah, for a year, was, oh, I'm working with these amazing people, I'm going to create this new record label. And I was like, oh, yeah, well, sure you are. You know, but on the other hand, what I have always said to my kids, and I think this is true across the board, is if you are a believer in that thing and you pursue it with incredible vigor, like if this is the thing that obsesses you and you pursue it with you know, hard work and seriousness and focus, great, right? If it's, I have a thing and I'm going to kind of, you know, I'm a dilettante, forget it. That's not right. But if you want to pursue something that is unlikely with all of your heart, I'm all in. And that's, right. I think that's what I've done my entire life. And so I hope that everybody has that opportunity. I know that it's a lucky circumstance that my kids do.
Right. David, is there anything that I've missed or gotten wrong or anything you want to highlight before we wrap up this conversation?
No, I mean, I think, you know, it's funny because you want to talk about risk and I want to talk about luck. And right. I think that the two are really correlated in a lot of ways, right?
Yes.
Because by taking risks, yeah, they're calculated risks, but risks are risks, right? Which means mm-hmm. that they could go poorly or they could go well. And I am such an optimist, as you know, for always, mm-hmm. evermore. I'm such an shameless optimist that to me, when given the opportunity to take a risk where there's some possibility that it goes poorly or some possibility it goes well, I assume it will go well.
Right. I'm the same way.
Dive in with, you know, everything. And then when it goes well, I'm like, ta-da, that's so amazing. And when it goes poorly, I'm like, huh, that's curious. And I move on. Right.
Right.
And right. I think that is important, right? Because if you're someone who's a pessimist, it is astonishingly hard mm-hmm. to take risks because right. all you see is the downside. You say like, oh, why would I do that? That would be so hard and so unlikely. My son who started this record label is just like me. And he's had moments where things don't work out. And he's so funny because he's just like, I can't believe that didn't work out. You're like, right. really? It was never working. He's like, oh, who knew, you know, that didn't work out. So I think that for this to work, for me to have lived this life and for people to be able to take risks, thoughtful risks, I think it is this beautiful alchemy of incredible optimism, you know, taking that risk, being all in. You can't be half in on a risk. You will fail if you're half in. So if you're going to take that risk, then you got to be all in and be an optimist and assume it works out. And then you have to be totally comfortable when it doesn't. And when it doesn't, you have to say like, wow, that was a great learning experience. What's my next risk? And that I've lived my life that way forever, like my entire life. And I will continue to live it that way. And I think it's amazing. And that may sound so awful to other people. It may sound so scary to other people. And I don't blame them. Great. Live your life the way you're comfortable, but from a risk and a reward and, you know, optimism standpoint, that is who I have always been.
I love it. And I have been too. And I know exactly what you're saying about the optimism. For me, I had this crazy health scare. And so that gave me permission to then do an about face and start taking serious risks, which have been so rewarding for me as well, both personally and professionally. But that a lot of us have a triggering event that informs that choice. And then others like you, maybe it was just evolving through time and it's great. So I love it. And I've loved this conversation, David. It's so inspiring and I'm so happy to be reconnected. Congratulations. And thank you for your generosity. I will echo what Adam Grant saw in you and what you wrote in that Wired piece. And it's just so refreshing. So thank you.
So fun to catch up.
I want to thank our incredible podcast team, producer David Seth Cohn and Precision Pictures LTD, and of course, the amazing Renee Green. If you're enjoying Inspiration Loves Company, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, rate and review us, and tell your family, friends, and colleagues. Oh, and one more thing. Be sure to join us next time.